high-achieving high school students are getting ready for another school year full of extracurricular activities, SAT prep courses, and AP classes. All of this to try to get into a great school, maybe even an Ivy League or other elite college. But our next guest calls these schools high-pressure conveyor belts. He's with us to make the argument against what elite colleges have become in the United States and to offer some alternatives. William DeResiewicz is with us now. He's former Yale professor and author of the new book, Excellent Sheep, The Miseducation of the American Elite and the Way to a Meaningful Life. Bill, welcome to Central Time.
Thanks for having me on.
So I want to talk first about what's at stake here. A lot of people listening may not be about to try to get a kid into an Ivy League college, but the people we're talking about here are going to be running this country or big parts of it in the future. What's at stake here? How important is it who goes to these elite universities and the kind of education they get?
Right. Well, first of all, what's at stake is exactly what you just said. It's the leadership of our country in the future. It's our present leadership because the system has been in place for a while. But I should say, it's not a small number of kids. I mean, aside from the fact that about 35,000 kids apply to Harvard every year, there's an estimate that about 10 to 15% of high school graduates are caught up in the admissions process for selective colleges. And that's a lot of kids. That's several hundred thousand a year. So even if your kid isn't aspiring to Harvard per se, I'm talking about, you know, maybe the top 100 schools, and that's a lot of kids involved.
And you describe in your book a growing almost arms race for kids looking to meet that admission barrier. How has it changed? How has it grown over time?
Right. It's important to say that this is not, you know, kids today or millennials or the last 10 years. This has been something that's been going on really since the mid-60s, certainly since the early 70s, and people have been writing about it since the 80s. I would say since U.S. News debuted its rankings, which was in the mid-80s. It's the same system I went through when I graduated from high school in 81. It's just getting worse and worse and worse. That phrase you used, the resume arms race. When I went to high school, the kids who got into Ivy League schools had, you know, three extracurriculars and three AP courses each. Now it's 10, 11, 12 extracurriculars, 7, 8, 9 AP courses. Who knows how much worse it could get in the future.
Well, and then looking at these students coming in, you describe them and you point to others who have described them as, on the surface, incredibly competent, incredibly talented, intelligent, capable people. But what's wrong? What are they missing as they get ready for that admissions process and then during school itself?
Right. So they are, you know, the book is called Excellent Sheep, which I should say is a phrase that came from one of my students at Yale. These students are certainly excellent in the sense that schools now describe it. They're academically extremely well prepared. But first of all, that doesn't mean that they are deep or independent or original thinkers, because, and there's so many students who've talked to me about this, people have written about this, the system inculcates a tremendous cynicism about school. School becomes like a video game you just need to crack to get to the next level. So they know how to get the A's, but they also know what the minimum amount they need to do to get an A is. That's part of it. The other part is, if they get to these schools by jumping through an endless succession of hoops, they become great hoop jumpers. And it means that they're not driven by an inner sense of purpose. They're doing what they know the adults want them to do. What I've discovered, and you really do have to look beneath the surface and listen to kids, is that there's a lot of anxiety, panic, sense of aimlessness, sense of isolation, because they can't talk about how much anxiety, panic, and sense of aimlessness they're feeling. This is not the normal anxiety of youth. These are kids who are under more pressure than kids have ever been under before in this country, more pressure than a kid should have to handle, and the mental health statistics tell us that they're cracking. What I also observed is that, you know, because they are never given help in trying to sort of be self-directed, they often come to the end of college, junior year, senior year, they start to run out of hoops. They have a lot of trouble figuring out what to do with themselves, and a lot of them just look for more hoops to jump through, which means law school or finance or consulting. And there are a limitless world. There is a limitless world of possibilities that should be open to these kids, but isn't, because they don't give themselves a chance to think about doing something unconventional.
Well, part of the core of what you're talking about seems to be the role of higher education. This is true from elite institutions and every college, every university in the country. There's a almost prevailing opinion that the goal is to prepare you for a job, to have a return on the investment, to get your career started. You're looking for something else, and you use the word self-directed. You want to see more talk of self-building, of figuring out who we are when we're in the education system.
But I want to be clear, I'm not looking for something else. I'm looking for something more.
Ah.
Those goals of job and career prep are perfectly valid. They've been understood to be an important part of college for a long time. I'm not against them. That's what your major's for. But we, uniquely among the world systems, also allow kids to take 2/3, 60% of their classes in other fields. And that's where schools have really started to fall down, precisely because there's been this relentless message that it's all about practicality. But you know what? Sometimes practicality isn't very practical. It isn't practical if it leads you to a goal that isn't the right goal for you to be pursuing. And one of the most important reasons to build a self or get in touch with yourself or discover who you are, or whatever phrase you want to use, is so that you can figure out in very practical terms what job, what career, what field, what path is the right one for you. You know, if you're doing something that doesn't give you a sense of joy, a sense of purpose, a sense of meaning, then you're not going to be very happy, and you might, you know, there's a good chance that you're not even going to be very successful either.
And so what you see happening, going back, you mentioned finance and consultancy, kids don't develop that sense of self, figuring out what they want to do, so they look at the same hoops that other people are viewing as the next successful step?
Well, that's a big part of it. I mean, there's an idea that kids go into those fields out of greed because they pay a lot of money, and I'm not discounting the greed motive. But when you talk to kids about why they're doing it or why they see their peers doing it, a lot of the answer is, you know, I don't really think that I have a passion. So why not go get a job that earns a lot of money? And that's actually a very reasonable logic to me. What's not reasonable is that we've developed a system that takes these very bright, ambitious kids and manages to get them to the age of 22 without any sense of what their passion is, or what their purpose is. I don't necessarily love the word passion. Or, even more, any sense of how to go about finding one. That's the tragedy here.
Now, in the book, you look at different points where this could start to be corrected. Let's start with parents and how they currently might put pressure on their high-achieving kids and what they might do differently to encourage this kind of learning you're talking about.
Well, the first thing I want to say, and it's very important for people to hear this, is that for most kids, a typical middle-class kid who's actually the normal kid who goes to these colleges, where you go has no effect on future earnings. This has been studied very carefully. You can get into a top school and still go to a state school, and you're going to do just as well if we're just looking at the money, right? Which is what I know parents are legitimately concerned about. Because what matters much more than where you go is who you are. And if you are that bright, talented, ambitious, energetic kid who could have gone to an elite school, you do just as well. So that's the first thing for parents to know. And the second thing I think for them to think about is what their motives are. Why do they feel that their kid has to get into a name brand private university? And very often, quite frankly, it has to do with the parents' own ego, their own social competition within their community or their extended family, their own sense that their grade for being a parent is where the kid got into school. And parents are, I mean, I describe the anxiety, the sort of all the mental health problems, literally mental health problems that a lot of high-achieving, affluent kids have now. Parents are often oblivious to it because they think that if you are a high achiever, if you're getting the grades, then everything is fine. And that's not the case. Parents need to get in touch with where their kids are really at.
We're talking to former Yale University professor William Derezowitz about his new book. It's called Excellent Sheep, The Miseducation of the American Elite and the Way to a Meaningful Life. You can join the conversation. What do you think about what our guest is saying, this idea that elite higher education is broken in the U.S.? Is there too much focus on building that college admissions portfolio, maybe during the high school years, to get into the college of your choice? Are students learning what they need to learn in higher education? Call in and share your experience. Your thoughts at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or email us at talk@wpr.org. We're continuing our conversation now with former Yale University professor William Derezowitz about the elite education system in the United States, the Ivy League and other schools on that caliber. We're taking your calls now. Do you agree with him that there's a problem with the way we're educating the leaders, in effect, of our future? Does this resonate with your college experience or your effort to get into a college? Did you go to one of these Ivy League schools? Are you considering them for your kids? Call in at 800-642-1234 or email talk@wpr.org. Oh, we'll go right to a caller. We've got Jeannie on the line in Eau Claire. Jeannie, hi, you're on the air.
Hi. My comment is I have a senior in high school who's a 3.9 student, 25 on his ACT, taking multiple AP classes this fall, and also trying to get a football scholarship, and he's made a commitment to a Division I school. And this summer, we had some very serious conversations because he was so stressed and had so much anxiety and all this pressure on these kids. I certainly agree with the author and this program, and it's very frustrating as a parent because we're not pushing him. It is the school and it's the system, and he's figuring this out along the way, but we really don't even know what to do as parents other than to just keep talking to him that a lot of this is just too much. He's put so much stress on himself to be the highest achiever and to get a scholarship and to get the highest ACT. In his school, there's competition for ACT scores. That's my comment.
Thank you so much for sharing that story. That's kind of exactly what you're talking about, Bill. Do you have advice for a parent who's not putting that pressure on but just feels that draw for their kid getting sucked into that pressure?
Yeah, you know, students have said this to me. It doesn't matter if your parents are crazy or not because everybody else's parent is crazy and the school is crazy and the environment is crazy. You know, I'm not going to pretend to have a simple answer to this dilemma. One thing I would say is that I was talking before about parents being out of touch. I'm not saying that Jeannie was out of touch with her son, but I will say that it's too bad that the conversation didn't happen until after her son was already out of high school. And this is exactly the kind of thing that I wish parents would talk about with their kids much earlier. And talk about, you know, what, I mean, just to be able to talk about why are you feeling stressed? Do you need to feel as stressed as you have to? Do you have to, you know, what does the, I mean, kids, they don't have a sense of what the future looks like, and they make a lot of assumptions that tend to be driven by the messages they're getting from the world around them. Do you have to drive yourself as much? What are the alternatives? What really matters to you? Why are you doing this? Let's explore other ways to go to college or other places you could go. I mean, again, these are not easy conversations to have, but I would say that families need to start by having the conversation.
Jeannie, thanks so much for the call, and good luck to you and your son. We've got Ron on the line now in Madison. Ron, hi.
Good afternoon. I have three kids. One went Ivy for undergraduate and graduate school. Two went state school for undergraduate. One of those kids went to Berkeley for West Coast Ivy, unquote, for graduate school. While I think all of them got a good education, they're all doing well, I also feel that perhaps Ivy, or the other case, the West Coast Ivy, was a door opener that put their resume or the write-up on top of the pile. I'd like the speaker to comment on that.
Gotcha, Ron. Thanks for the call. So even if the education isn't better at that elite school, it's good on the resume, and you hear about the contacts you make being a key to future business success.
Right, right. Again, let's remember that studies show that if you're just looking at earnings, it actually doesn't matter. But it's absolutely true. It is absolutely true that these schools open doors, put you in a network, contacts, etc. And I want to be very clear about this. I am not saying that this choice is without cost. If you want to be ushered into the elite, you would do very well to go to an Ivy League school or a place like Stanford. The question is, at what cost? There are costs on both sides, and that's what I want people to realize. It is not a cost-free proposition, and I'm not even talking about tuition money. It is not a cost-free proposition to go to an elite school, and that's exactly how it's being presented. This is going to set you up for life. Well, not necessarily. It could end up making you a very unhappy person. And that's what people need to think about.
Well, another cost on a broader scale, if these elite schools are the ticket to an elite life, at least for some, you point out that the people who can do this admission process are the people who can afford to do it, who can pay for extracurricular activities, who have the time. And this ultimately is, I guess, strengthening, hardening a class segregation in this country.
Absolutely. I mean, again, we have extensive statistics that bear this out. Socioeconomic stratification is severe at selective colleges, and it's getting worse. And the main reason is not tuition money, although that's obviously an issue. It is how much it costs to create one of these hoop-jumping machines, one of these achievement machines. And to me, the real answer, although it would be nice if the elite private institutions reformed their admissions process so that you didn't have to become one of these kids, what we really need to do is rebuild the great public higher education we used to have in this country, and to a certain extent we still have. And listen, you guys are in Wisconsin. You have one of the best public university systems in the country. I don't know the statistics in Wisconsin. I suspect that things are in trouble there because they're in trouble everywhere, and that state funding has been cut for decades because it's been cut everywhere long before 2008. We need to make the investment in our kids. We need to stop making them take out student loans and go back to a time when, for example, the University of California was tuition-free until the early 1980s. And I'm urging people who can hear me in Wisconsin, vote for politicians that are going to raise taxes on the affluent to pay for public higher education for everybody.
Well, Bill, short of that, what would you like to see maybe right now or next year from the admissions process, from the institutions we're talking about, to take some of the heat off, to broaden the different kind of learning you want to see?
Well, it's hard. I mean, I'll get to specific suggestions, but the sad truth is that there's very little that you can propose that rich families aren't going to be able to game, you know, like college essays, right, that are supposed to show the real kid. Well, you know, we all know that they're coached, if not ghostwritten now. I would limit the number of extracurriculars. I would ask schools to stop giving the large admissions preferences they currently give to athletes and to legacies, people who went to that school, let alone to donors. Don't be impressed by any opportunity that's been enabled by parental wealth. I think affirmative action should be based on class instead of race, or at least class in addition to race. But the truth is, are these things going to happen? I mean, you know, private institutions have reformed themselves in the past, but they're only ever going to go so far because they're private institutions that depend on having a certain critical mass of wealthy families.
As we wrap up, if our leaders of the future continue to be the excellent sheep of your title, what do we lose in terms of the leadership we get, the creativity in government, in industry, and elsewhere?
Well, look, I mean, I think it's widely agreed now, at least I hope it is, that our leadership class is pretty comprehensively failing across government, banks, corporations, academia itself, the nonprofit world. And they all seem to be failing in exactly the same way and in exactly the way you would predict from the way they've been trained. They're adult versions of excellent sheep. They're narrowly technocratic. They're out of touch with the rest of society because they grew up in a socioeconomically homogenous environment. They're risk-averse. They're self-serving, but at the same time very self-satisfied. This matters to all of us because this is the system that for 50 years has been giving us our leaders.
Bill, we'll leave it there. Thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you very much.
That was William Derezowitz. He's a former Yale University professor. We've been talking about his new book, Excellent Sheep, The Miseducation of the American Elite and the Way to a Meaningful Life. He mentioned toward the end there the student loan debt issue. We'll be talking about that very issue tomorrow on Central Time from 3:30 to 4 o'clock. It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. My co-host, Veronica Rickert, will be back tomorrow. Coming up on Central Time, 2 years ago, the FDA approved Truvada, the first ever drug to help prevent the transmission of HIV, but people have been slow to start using it. We'll find out why. First, after a lot of speculation, fast food giant Burger King announced today the purchase of Canadian restaurant chain Tim Hortons. The deal would create the third largest quick service restaurant company in the world and tens of billions of dollars in sales. The move also sets the stage for Burger King to move its operations to Canada and save on taxes, using a method called corporate tax inversion. Economists say that's becoming an increasingly popular maneuver. It could have some serious ramifications for the U.S. economy. Here to talk more about tax inversion and how it works is Chris Farrell, senior economics contributor for Marketplace Money. Chris, welcome back to Central Time.
Well, it's good to be here.
Well, at the core of the deal here between Burger King and Tim Hortons, not donut burgers, but this sticky thing called tax inversion. Can you define what that is for us?
So tax inversion is a multinational corporation, and it's taxed here in the U.S., and it has we have a 35% corporate tax rate. And you take over a foreign company, another multinational corporation, you move your headquarters to that foreign company, which might be based in Ireland or in Canada or in England, and you take advantage of their lower tax rate. So often, very little changes. If it's a U.S. company, the U.S. executives still live in the U.S., much of the business may be done in the U.S., but the headquarters has changed, the tax rate has changed, the effective tax rate has changed, and that can free up for a multinational corporation an enormous amount of cash.
Now, from the U.S. perspective, are we losing all of the tax revenue from Burger King or just the stuff they collected overseas that we were previously able to tax or over the border, I should say?
No, we're not. We're not losing everything, and far from it. But what it does for the multinational corporation is, besides just lowering the overall tax rate, you know, taking advantage of the overall tax rate, is there some really perverse incentives built in the U.S. corporate tax system? Which, for example, GE has $57 billion in cash overseas. And as long as it keeps it overseas, it doesn't get taxed. If it brought it back here into the U.S., what we call repatriation, it would be taxed. So if you then move your headquarters to another country, you can take that cash that's over there, and you can kind of shuffle it around the world with a little more freedom. So actually, a lot of this is less to do with the effective tax rate, although that's obviously clear, but there's also just greater freedom of what you can do with your cash flow without worrying so much about U.S. tax rates. And then in terms of what you're doing in the U.S. domestically, you know, you might load up those units up with debt, so you would lower the tax rate that way. So for multinational corporations, they're still going to pay taxes in the U.S. And if their executives are living in the U.S., you know, they're still going to be paying taxes, and their employees are still going to be paying taxes. But from the point of view of the corporation, it liberates cash flow, absolutely, but it also increases their freedom of maneuver with their money.
And are more and more companies doing this now?
So it's been growing. You know, according to Bloomberg, since 1982, there have been 41 of these corporate inversions, you know, moving from the U.S. to a lower tax country, Ireland being a classic example. And there have been about 12, 14 since 2012, so it's really picking up. The pace is truly picking up. Now, in terms of the Burger King Horton, there is a little bit of a gain there. This does seem to be less driven by corporate inversion and more driven by Horton is a really important company in Canada. It's a big company. And so by making this move, it's going to ease some of the political potential backlash, and you know, regulatory authorities are going to look a little more kindly on them. I think there are still some tax benefits, but it's not huge, which has been the case with some of the pharmaceutical companies.
Interesting. So, what does the U.S. stand to lose for the wider inversions going on here, not just the Burger King one?
Well, there's just the general fear that this is going to turn into, is going to continue, is going to turn into an ongoing wave, and then we're just losing more and more money in terms of, you know, our overall tax collection. And so if you look at both sides of the political aisle, there's a general agreement that there's a fundamental problem with our corporate tax system. And so President Obama's proposed a 28% tax rate, and I believe the congressional Republicans have countered with a 25% tax rate. Now, you know, that's just your normal negotiation. Here's the issue, and here's the really big issue here in, with the U.S., is as you lower that income tax, that corporate tax rate, in order to pay for it, you start saying, well, what we have to do is, you know, we got to close these deductions, these credits, you know, these loopholes. Well, once you start doing that, people get very upset, right? I mean, that is just a real problem there. And secondly, as you lower the corporate income tax rate, you then create an incentive for well-off individuals and smaller businesses to become corporations. Rather, what are you going to do about the Schedule C companies, right? There's a lot of Schedule C companies. You tax at the personal income tax rate. The more you create a gap between your high personal income tax rate and your corporate tax rate, the more you have an incentive for people to become corporations, which I guess the Supreme Court has said they already are. But anyway, you have this tax incentive. So it opens up just a can of worms, the details in boy, with this Congress, there's just no way you're going to negotiate a deal.
Well, that's what I was going to say. I mean, it's very hard to get any kind of legislation passed. Something like this, where you're in effect squeezing a water balloon. Everything you do over here is going to swell up over there.
That's right.
How are you going to get everybody on the same page to do it? Nobody is hopeful, I'm guessing, that something's going to change anytime soon?
Well, the question is, it's kind of an intolerable situation. And the more it happens, the more intolerable it becomes. So there are two strategies that are out there. One is, let's create a moat. Let's just make it harder for companies to do these corporate tax inversions. Now, the problem with that approach is that was done in 2004. And that was supposed to be, there's legislation that was passed, and that was supposed to be the end of corporate tax inversions. Guess what? We're talking about it in 2014. It didn't exactly stop them. It slowed them down for a while. So you can create a moat, but these multinational corporations are very clever. They have global operations. And if it's in their financial interest, they're going to do some maneuvers once they figure out how to get around the moat. The other idea, which is favored by a lot of economists, is what if we got rid of the corporate tax system altogether? We really lowered the corporate tax system. And in return, what you do is you increase the taxes on high-income individuals, or you have a value-added tax. Greg Mankiw of Harvard University has proposed that. Or you substitute for the corporate income tax some sort of carbon tax, because, you know, there's this old adage in the tax system, you know, tax things we don't like and don't tax things we do like. So most of us are worried about climate change, sustainability, the environment, and a carbon tax is a nice way of dealing with that issue, and most of us like to take money home. So maybe we don't tax corporations as much, but we tax the environment or their environmental impact. So these are the discussions that are going out there. My own guess is we're going to do something like a moat, because you can't do the more fundamental action in Washington, D.C. right now.
One other response, not legislative at all. President Obama has invoked the phrase economic patriotism. We've seen responses already, including one U.S. senator to this Burger King thing, calling for a boycott of the Whopper. Do those sort of bully pulpit sort of responses make any difference?
They make a minor difference. I think that you can't separate morality and the tax system to some extent. The tax system itself is built on notions of fairness, and this seems unfair. And so it adds to the heated rhetoric. I think that they're doing, corporations do what their job is to create goods and services, and, they'll, within certain limits, they'll do a lot of stuff. It adds to the rhetoric. It makes it actually, to my mind, more difficult to pass legislation. But again, because of some of this heated rhetoric, my guess is we're going to embrace some kind of version of a moat, kind of make it a little harder for companies to do this. It's not going to succeed. What will succeed is more fundamental corporate tax reform, and good luck on that one.
Chris, thanks a lot for joining us again.
Thank you.
That was Chris Farrell, senior economics contributor for Marketplace Money. For more coverage on this subject of tax inversion beyond Burger King, make sure to join Kathleen Dunn tomorrow at 1 o'clock. Since the AIDS epidemic began in the early 80s, doctors the world over have been trying to find ways to cure or prevent the disease. In 2012, 3 decades after the official start of the epidemic, the FDA approved the first drug ever to help prevent HIV for people at a high risk of transmission. It's called Truvada, also known as PrEP, and it's said to be over 90% effective. Now, 2 years after the drug's release onto the market, its uptake has been slow. It's been the subject of some debate within the HIV prevention community and the gay communities. Some worry that widespread use of Truvada will undo the work public health organizations have done to encourage condom use. Use of the drug has also been stigmatized, with president of the AIDS Healthcare Foundation, Michael Weinstein, calling it a party drug, and at $13,000 a year, it's difficult to pay for. Here with us now to talk about the role Truvada is playing here in Wisconsin and around the country, we have Nick Olson, Director of Clinical Pharmacy at the AIDS Resource Center of Wisconsin. Nick, welcome to Central Time.
Thanks for having me.
So what is the AIDS Resource Center of Wisconsin's stance on using this medication, Truvada, as a preventative for HIV?
Well, I think that the evidence that's out there to support the use of Truvada as a prevention mechanism for HIV infection, it's overwhelming. I mean, if you look at the studies, there's several robust ones out there. I mean, some of them go as high as a 92% effective rate. But one of the things that I think is really important to note about that is in all of these studies and in looking at the CDC's guidance for how to utilize this particular medication as a prevention mechanism, it's part of a comprehensive transmission prevention program where they're talking about safe sex practices and reduction of risky behaviors as far as transmission goes, from injection drug use to different styles of sexual practice. And so I guess the AIDS Research Center of Wisconsin stance on this is that this is an effective tool, but it's just one tool in the toolbox and needs to be part of this comprehensive sort of education program around HIV transmission prevention.
So the message you're hoping is not out there is, this is a magic bullet, don't worry about anything else.
No, that's certainly not the message that we're trying to do. And I think, I mean, this phenomena is no different than any other sort of issue as it relates to healthcare. I mean, I don't think anybody would think, well, now that there are cholesterol medications or high blood pressure medications out there, that people are going to stop taking, you know, watching their diet and stop exercising because they've got this magic pill. I think the same thing could be said about this sort of thing. Just because there is a pill that helps prevent HIV transmission, that's not, you can't separate that or carve it out from the other things a person needs to do to protect themselves.
Now, as I understand it, this medication, this is not a vaccine we're talking about. How does this drug work for preventing HIV?
Right. So actually, Truvada has been around since about 2004, when it was actually approved to treat HIV in combination with other medications. And so the way this mechanism works, not to get too fancy with it, but basically it stops the HIV from being able to replicate once it's inside of your white blood cells. And so in essence, what the thought is that if we can prevent HIV from replicating once it gets inside your body, before it even gets to the white blood cells to cause kind of this long-term infection issue, that the idea is to kind of stamp it out there. But as you can see, this is not a 100% complete prevention mechanism. So this does fail, you know, at worst 10% of the times, and at other times, if you don't take the medication, it drops into the 40 to 30% efficacy range.
Now, this has only been around as a preventative approved medication for a couple of years. Do we have numbers yet on how widely used this is here in Wisconsin?
Yeah, no, that's a great question, and I wish I had better utilization data for you. So there's a couple of, you know, the best access to this sort of stuff is from the pharmaceutical industry, and, you know, best as we can tell, since about 2012-2013, they have defined only about 1,800 people who have filled prescriptions for the express consent of using it for HIV prevention. Now, there are some confounding factors here too. Truvada, it can be used to treat hepatitis B infection. It is used, you know, of course, to treat HIV infection. So it's really hard sometimes to tease out the data, but I think what is obvious is that, you know, the United States averages about, you know, 48 to 50,000 new HIV infections a year. If we can only find 1,700 people that are utilizing this, there's a discrepancy gap there that we need to close.
Well, and that's a huge question there. Why is that number small? Why has uptake been slow?
Yeah. Again, there's multifactorial reasons. I think you alluded to it in your introduction. This is not an inexpensive medication. And a lot of times folks need to rely on third-party payers, insurances, Medicaids, Medicares of the world to help pay or to supplement the cost of this. And so if you're a third-party payer and you're looking at, you know, paying out $13,000 or $14,000 a year for this, you know, what's the turnaround? You know, there hasn't really been cost utilization analyses done to see what is the turn back. If I'm paying out $14,000, how much am I preventing an infection? What's the cost savings there? And then in addition to the cost piece, you're looking at, you know, this is a medication that, you know, patients should be engaging discussions with their primary care providers about it. Unfortunately, because of the way that HIV is transmitted, it's when it has to do with sexual transmission or the use of injection drugs, I think it's taboo subjects. There's a comfort level of patients being able to talk to their primary care providers about it. And of course, I think we all know primary care providers, they're taxed in our healthcare society right now. They have lots of things that they need to worry about. There's lots of other care issues that are being layered onto them. And this is just one more thing that, you know, they have to concern themselves with. And it's one more thing that, quite frankly, some of them just aren't entirely comfortable in dealing with.
If you had to do some triage here and pick a community or a couple of communities that you would hope would have access to this preventive medication, where would you start?
Yeah, right. So, I mean, I think if you look that, you got to follow the HIV epidemiologic trends. And right now in the United States, there is the category of individuals or the demographic of individuals who are at the greatest risk for acquiring HIV infection are young African-American males. And we're talking about young males, you know, between 18 and 30 years old, who engage in sexual practices with other men. That is an actual demographic that is on the rise for HIV infection. And so really, I think you need to look at access for that, for those particular subset of individuals. But really, if you look at the indication for, you know, the use of Truvada, it's for, you know, heterosexual males and females. It's for people that are in monogamous relationships where one person's HIV positive and one person's not. It's for commercial sex workers who are engaging in sexual practices in an unprotected fashion, or they've acquired a bacterial sexually transmitted infection from it, and injection drug users. So it's very hard to carve out just one. But if you look at the epidemiology, the one subsect that's on the rise as far as HIV infection in the United States is that young African-American men who have sex with men population.
You mentioned that in some cases there's stigma associated with taking the drug, with asking a physician about the drug. Why is that?
Yeah, again, I think, you know, when you're talking about how HIV is transmitted, you're talking about, you know, sexual practices, you're talking about use of injection drugs. You know, as you're talking about, in a lot of cases, it's still a disease that disproportionately affects gay males. I think when you're talking about these subjects, these are some subjects that make some people fairly uncomfortable to talk about, and in some cases are very taboo to talk about. And so, you know, I think from a patient to be able to come up to have the comfort level with their provider to talk to them about that, from a provider, you know, they have no problems asking somebody about how their blood pressure is doing or how their diet is or are they controlling their blood sugars. But they also should be talking to individuals about what sort of sexual practices that they engage in that could be putting them at risk. And that's a very hard conversation, I think, for individuals to have with their providers.
Briefly reading about this, it seems like a contentious issue within the gay community, with people split maybe generationally over whether or not to take it. Briefly, can you outline that?
Yeah, I think you know, some of the people are saying, again, that, and I think mistakenly so, that, you know, oh, now that we've got this drug, you know, we're in the clear here. We don't have to worry about safe sex practices anymore because we can get access, we can get on this medication, and it'll prevent us from getting HIV. But like I said before, all of the data shows that this is not a 100% effective tool. And if you look at all of the guidance out there, what's great about this is, you know, it's kind of designed to, it's trying to engage somebody to see their practitioner once every 3 or 4 months to, you know, have STD testing, to see how things are going, to go through harm reduction strategies and prevention reduction strategies. And so I think the key part that we need to get out about this is that this is just not a single tool, but this is just one tool amongst many that somebody can utilize to cause prevention. And I think that that's mistaken.
As we wrap up, what do you hope for in the near-term future in Wisconsin?
Yeah, so I think one of the things that the AIDS Research Center of Wisconsin is really interested in doing is we want to take a lead in kind of creating a consortium or a working group of individuals that this affects across the state of Wisconsin. Let's get providers together. Let's get payers together. Let's get patient advocacy groups together. And let's get us all on the same table to talk about how are we going to more effectively utilize this tool. I think it's no doubt that this stuff helps curb HIV transmission. I think it's about getting people comfortable and being able to use it, setting up systems so that they'll be able to pay for it and so patients can be followed up and get the additional counseling and work that they need in order to help them live healthier lives.
Nick, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thanks for having me.
We've been speaking with Nick Olson, Director of Clinical Pharmacy at the AIDS Resource Center of Wisconsin, about the use of Truvada to prevent HIV in Wisconsin and around the country.